To be an immigrant in Donald Trump's America is not easy. These days, that story is focusing on kids separated from their parents at the Mexican border. This morning, we'll get an update on the latest developments with nine of those children who have come to Kansas and are residing at the Villages in Topeka. Then we'll speak with one immigrant who spent 6 months in detention facilities with her child. We'll find out what life was like in such a place. Finally, the Reverend Rick Behrens is here. He leads the Grandview Park Presbyterian Church in Kansas City, Kansas, that has a sizable congregation with a strong Latino population. Later, we get an update on the situation in Kansas with the children separated from their parents at the border who are now residing in that group home in Topeka. For that, let's bring in Maddie Fox with the Kansas News Service. Maddie, good morning.
Good morning.
Bring us up to speed here. There are nine kids staying at the Villages in Topeka. Is that number still accurate?
It could be. It might not be. I mean, with group homes like this, the numbers are always in flux depending on whether new kids are coming in or, you know, hopefully kids have been placed elsewhere, have been placed with family.
Do we know how old they are?
The shelter can take anywhere from age 6 to age 18. We've heard that they're usually younger than 18, but they've got kids across the whole spectrum.
And they were brought here when exactly?
Well, so the kids who would have been separated from their parents, the director of the shelter told me that they've only seen those kids in the past couple weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. The kids who were already there as unaccompanied minors, they could have come any time in the last couple years.
Do we know why the Villages was picked as a location to place these children?
We do. So the Villages has a contract with the Office of Refugee Resettlement and has had that contract since early 2017 to take at the time, it was unaccompanied minors, so kids who crossed the border either alone or without with adults who weren't their family members. And so those kids are placed at shelters across the country, depending on where the Office of Refugee Resettlement wants to place them. So the shelter in Topeka, the Villages, got a contract from the federal government to be one of those shelters. And then those shelters are now being used to house the kids that have been separated from their parents as well.
You know, Democratic lawmakers in Kansas have been demanding that they be allowed to inspect the facility to see how the children are faring. That hasn't happened, but yesterday there was an inspection by a state official. What happened there?
Well, so my understanding is the inspection was actually Friday. That was by the Department for Children and Families. The shelter in Topeka is the contract they have with the federal government means that the Department for Children and Families doesn't actually have jurisdiction, doesn't have oversight over the kids that they have placed there by the federal government, these immigrant kids. But the shelter is also, the Villages is also licensed by Kansas as a youth residential center. So it can take kids who are in the state foster care system. Mm. And using that fact that it's licensed by the state, DCF was able to go in and look at the facility.
And what do they say about it and how the kids are doing?
They said the kids are doing well. They seem generally happy with how the shelter's been, how the Villages has been handling kids. They seem impressed by the facilities. It sounds like to them, in as much as everything can be good with kids who have been really, really traumatized, things are good with these kids.
You know, there's also, Maddie, been this expression of interest in helping out here from a group of lawyers. What's that about?
Well, so former U.S. Attorney for Kansas Barry Grissom has been sort of assembling a team of volunteer lawyers and paralegals and legal secretaries to represent these kids to make sure that they can get reunited with their families. I talked to Barry Grissom yesterday, and he says they're not sure yet what they're going to do about seeing if these kids can stay in the country, but their priority is to make sure that if these kids don't have legal representation, they can provide it. And if they do, they can make sure that whoever is representing these kids is putting their best interests in getting back together with their families first.
Is there really any realistic hope that these children will one day see their parents again?
That's a tough question. I'm not sure. I think that there's a good chance that they'll see some family members again. I mean, the goal for kids who are placed in shelters like these is to reunite them with some family member or someone who can act as a sponsor in the U.S. But whether it's their families who presumably have been detained and are being prosecuted, I don't know.
I mean, do we even know? I don't mean to get down too far in the weeds here. Do authorities and officials in Topeka at the Villages even know the names of these kids?
They do.
Okay.
I would assume like these, and if these kids are six and up, they probably can speak for themselves on that.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Good point. Yeah. Hey, do we have any sense of how long the children will be in Kansas?
We don't for sure. The villages have said that in previous reunification of kids with families, these would be kids, again, who were unaccompanied, not these kids who were separated. But they've had kids anywhere from like 3 weeks to about 5 months. 5 months is really on the high end, but they've been able to get these kids out and with either family members or other qualified sponsors within 5 months.
You know, this has got to be so scary for these kids. You've already alluded to that, Maddie.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of just how overwhelming their predicament is, especially for kids as young as these children are?
Right. Well, and this is one of the wrinkles about these kids is that separating kids from their families and having them in a group facility, even if it's a really nice group facility, even if they're getting, you know, psychological help, even if they're getting counseling, it's really traumatic. And that trauma has a lot of long-term effects. I mean, studies have shown it's bad for kids academically. It's bad for kids in the way they regulate their emotions. It's bad for kids in their behaviors. I mean, this trauma can come out in all sorts of different ways later on in their lives, and it's really just not good. And then you throw in the added problems that these kids have probably gone through a lot of trauma just to get to the U.S., and they're now in a place where, you know, they don't know anyone, and not everybody speaks their same language. I mean, it sounds like the villages has a lot of bilingual staff, but still, it's going to be really traumatic, and that's going to really be tough on these kids in the long run and in the short run.
Maybe just a final point here. How transparent are the villages being when it comes to the handling of these children? How transparent is the state being as to what's going on here? Are you as a reporter getting enough information to really be able to gauge all this?
I mean, I'd always love more information. I'd love it if I could go see the villages for myself and meet some of these kids. But that's always something that's hard, even with kids who aren't in federal custody. I mean, I can't really go into foster care shelters most of the time and talk to kids. They've been more transparent as of late. I got a lot of information about the conditions these kids are in last Friday. But they're in a contract with the federal government with an agency that's not known for being really forthcoming with reporters. So there's some barriers there. I would point out, though, that it's not really an issue of the state being less transparent because, again, these kids aren't in state custody. They don't have a lot of oversight over these kids.
Okay, that's Maddie Fox with the Kansas News Service. Maddie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to the story of Veronica, a woman, and that's not her real name, who spent a few months in detention centers in Texas and Pennsylvania and can speak to us about what that experience was like. She was detained with her son, who's now 6 years old. Veronica, nice to have you. Welcome.
Un placer conocerte. Bienvenida.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
She's joined by Ramon Valdez, who is the program manager at the Innovation Law Lab that works to give immigrants accurate information and quality legal counsel when navigating this country's oh-so-complicated immigration system. Ramon, nice to have you, too. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start with you, Ramon. Outline, if you would, Veronica's story. Why did she come to this country?
And so Veronica comes from Honduras, a country that has a murder rate that is almost parallel to Syria. It's a little bigger than Kansas, but it has 9 million people. And the majority of the country is controlled by gangs like MS-13, M-18. And it's gotten to the point where if you're threatened by the gang because you're being extortioned or because they're trying to recruit your child, you can't go to the police because folks know that if you go to the police, oftentimes they will report it directly to the gang and the gang will come and it'll just make matters worse. And so when folks are in that situation, they flee, they come to the United States. And so she was actually a worker at a store that was being extortioned by the M18 gang, was threatened directly. And so she chose to protect her life and the life of her 4-year-old child at the time.
You know, I'm aware of what you're talking about. I've read about this, but hearing you describe it, it sounds like something just in a horror story novel or film here, Ramon.
Absolutely. We have an impression of what gangs are in the United States because many of these gangs actually started in the United States in cities like Los Angeles. But what they've become in Central America is very different. They're transnational criminal organizations. They are very much a social political power. There's proof of them working directly with the government to get them more votes. It's extremely corrupt. And for you to report them to the police, for you to say no to cooperating with them is very much an act of disobedience. And the way that they keep their power is through egregious and just awful forms of violence and murder, as I'm sure you're aware.
And they are literally controlling the country.
Absolutely, they have their territories. Central America is at the moment currently populated with these micro wars between gangs. It's a humanitarian crisis, is what it is.
What happened to Veronica then, Ramon, when she got to the border?
And so she arrived in 2016. This was under the Obama administration. And so family detention, a lot of people are learning about it for the first time right now under this administration. But it's actually a policy that started in 2014 under President Obama. And so when she arrived at the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas, she was first interviewed by the asylum office. And so their job is to determine whether or not you have credible fear, and if you do, they'll admit you into the United States so that you can apply for asylum here in a community outside of detention, and if you don't, then you're subject to deportation. She ended up in legal limbo and ended up being transferred to Berks County, Pennsylvania, where she was detained for another few months with her 4-year-old child.
I was going to say she was with her son throughout this time, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And okay, well, could you ask Veronica what life was like at those two centers, the one in Texas and then the one in Pennsylvania?
Entonces, Veronica, ¿nos puede explicar un poquito acerca de cómo es la vida cuando usted estaba viviendo en estos centros de detención, primero en Texas y luego en Pensilvania?
Fueron muchos días de angustia esperando una respuesta que diera aliento a la respuesta que yo buscaba.
And so there were many days of anguish. I was waiting day by day for a decision on this question that I was asking.
Mm. Just how monotonous, how boring was life at the centers?
Entonces, platícanos cómo de aburrido era la vida en los centros o cómo era la vida en nuestros centros.
Era totalmente un encierro sin teniendo restricciones de que a tal hora de las 6 de la tarde ya no podíamos estar en el patio.
And so it was an excruciating moment of control. And so, for example, after 6 p.m., we could no longer be outside in the patio and we'd have to come back in.
And so that was very difficult.
Entonces eso era muy difícil vivir de esa manera.
Es muy difícil para uno de adulto y los niños mucho más. Estaba en ese lugar con mi hijo. Él pedía jugar y ya no había tiempo.
And so it's very difficult for one as an adult, but it's even more difficult for the child. So oftentimes he would ask me that he wanted to go out and be free and play, and because of the restrictions, we couldn't.
You know, Ramon, I wonder if you can ask Veronica this too, because there are undoubtedly people out there listening right now who are thinking, we shouldn't feel sorry for Veronica at all. She broke the law. What does she say to that?
Entonces, le vamos a hacer esta pregunta porque muchas personas tal vez escuchando piensen, bueno, está bien que eso le pase a alguien como Verónica porque ellos quebraron la ley. ¿Qué le dirías a una persona así?
Pienso que somos seres humanos y lo que pasa con estas personas que están detenidas para mí se me hace muy injusto.
And so first I tell them that we are human beings and what is happening to these families that are detained is extremely unjust.
You know, Ramon, she's now in the Kansas City area. How did she get here? Yeah.
And so she was detained in Berks for a few months after, with the help of lawyers through collaborative projects like we have all over the country, she was able to receive admission into the United States because they determined that she did have credible fear in Honduras, which to us was very obvious, but she had to go through the legal process. And so then it's just a matter of being sponsored by a family member. She comes and she lives with family to wait out the length of her legal proceedings. So she's going to her hearings at the Kansas City Immigration Court. She has pro bono representation with a wonderful attorney locally. And so later this year, she will have her final trial, which is adversarial. The government has a lawyer, and they will ultimately decide whether or not she can stay here protected or if she will be removed back to Honduras.
What would be your guess as a lawyer as to her prospects for staying?
Oh, first, I should clarify, I'm not a lawyer. Unfortunately, in the past couple of months, there have been changes to the law. So Attorney General Jeff Sessions has actually revoked some very important case law to cases like hers, where the persecutor is a private actor, not a government actor, which is very common around the world. And so we will fight that case tooth and nail, and hopefully we will win. But unfortunately, under the current political climate and legal changes, it's there is a chance that she won't be able to receive asylum.
I wonder if you could just ask Veronica a final thing. You know, how is she doing and how is her son doing today?
Entonces, la última pregunta para usted, Veronica, es ¿cómo está usted y cómo está su hijo?
Después que salimos de ese lugar donde tuvimos que pasar muchas experiencias, salimos de ese lugar, llegamos a casa. Mi hijo no quería expresarse, tener que platicar era muy difícil para él después de ese encierro que vivimos.
When we first arrived and left detention, it was very difficult for him to communicate. He became very unresponsive, and so it was very difficult to get him to talk to us oftentimes.
Llegamos a casa de mi hermano. Mi hermano se acercaba a él, lo saludaba, preguntaba cómo estaba, cómo había sido su día. Él simplemente agachaba su cabeza y quedaba callado.
And so my brother, his uncle, would oftentimes ask him very simple questions. How's your day? How are you doing? What did you do today? And oftentimes he would duck his head and not respond to those very simple questions.
Is he talking more today?
Él está comunicándose más hoy.
Ahora está tratando de platicar más. Tuve que sentarme con él algunas veces y hacerle saber que no tenía que tener miedo. Ya no estábamos libres, que ya estábamos bien. Que la vida iba a ser mejor ahora.
And so he is doing better. I had to sit him down and talk to him various times over the course of these last couple of years to explain to him that he didn't have to be afraid. We weren't detained anymore, that it was a very different situation and there was no reason for him to be so timid around others.
This must be so difficult for her.
Esto debería ser muy difícil para usted.
Muy difícil como mamá. Había momentos también cuando ya estando en casa a hora de dormir, antes de dormir él preguntaba, mamá, ¿vamos a volver a pasar por esos lugares donde pasamos antes?
It is very difficult for me, especially as a mother. Oftentimes he's asked me before going to bed, mom, are we going to go back to those places where we were before?
Ramon, how likely is it that Veronica and her son will wind up staying here permanently? Again, do you have any, just what's your gut telling you today?
Under this administration, I don't want to make any predictions. Yeah, things change week by week. We have an entire summer and fall before her hearing. We're hoping for the best, but we are expecting the worst. The good thing is that there is an appellate process through which we can appeal cases that are denied, which if that happens, then we will continue the fight.
If she was sent back to Honduras, what would she do? If you can ask her, yeah.
Entonces, si usted tuviera que regresar o fuera deportada para Honduras, ¿qué haría usted?
Pienso mucho en ese momento y me atemoriza pensar no solamente si fuese deportada, sino también tener que recibir ese maltrato de parte de agentes de inmigración.
That's actually a question that I think about a lot. And it's not just returning to that place that I fear so much. I also fear the treatment that we receive from immigration officials.
I want to bring the Reverend Rick Behrens into our conversation now. Again, he's a senior pastor at Grandview Park Presbyterian Church in Kansas City, Kansas, that has a congregation with a strong Latino population. Rick, the Trump administration has hardened the approach this country is taking to illegal immigrants. Some who are here illegally are being rounded up and sent home. What is the mood right now inside your church about what's going on, you know, about this president and his policies?
Well, Steve, there clearly is fear, as Veronica has expressed. There's fear. That's natural, but that fear has been around for a long time. People who've been here have been experiencing this fear and this understanding that we're dealing with a broken and inhumane immigration system for the last 20 years and been looking to try to fix it. But as you hear in Veronica's voice, there's strength. There's strength, there's faith, there's people who are standing up and speaking out like Veronica's doing today. There's people who are recognizing that it's really our common humanity that's on the line in this struggle, our understanding of each other as brothers and sisters and fellow humans.
Yeah.
And to dehumanize, to degrade people, children, and put them in cages, wrap them in space blankets and put them in cold rooms to control them. This is all dehumanization. It's all part of a larger structure that's hurting people. And that's why people are standing up and speaking out. This morning, 50 people went to the ICE office this morning to stand and to speak out against the deportation of Kenya and her 3-year-old son, Noah. Kenya's 6 months pregnant, was deported this morning. Her partner, who came and accompanied little Noah, her 3-year-old, back to be with her, he was detained this morning. We don't know if he's still detained or not. And in the process, her attorney, who was escorting Luis and the baby into the ICE office, she was shoved to the ground by an ICE officer this morning.
This is a woman who's pregnant.
No,
this is
the lawyer.
Woman who's
the lawyer, okay. Andrea Martinez, was shoved to the ground this morning by an ICE agent as she attempted to accompany her client into the ICE office. So there's this violence, this inhumanity that's happening, that's degrading our community, that's degrading our life together. The encouraging thing is that people are standing up and speaking out, that more people are understanding what's been going on, particularly since 2014 with family detention. But all along, we've been separating people from their families. This is one of the bases of our broken system, is to separate people from their families. And Jesus, you know, Jesus said, he separated the nations into two groups. He said, there are two groups of nations. There are those who welcomed me as a stranger, and there are those who didn't welcome me as a stranger. And to the ones who welcomed me, Jesus said, come and enjoy the kingdom of God. Enjoy life in my presence, in love and grace. To those who don't welcome the stranger, it's not going to be good for you, because we're not just not welcoming the stranger. We are torturing the stranger. It's part of our system. It's part of what's happening right now.
Rick, I'm wondering if some of your members feel that all this attention that's being paid to immigration, you know, does it amount to something of a vendetta that's aimed squarely at Latinos?
I can't speak for everyone, but I know that there is a pretty clear racist element to this, as we can see and understand it.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much right out there. Our president said when he announced his candidacy for president that he was coming after Mexicans. So,
you know, as the senior pastor at Grandview Park Presbyterian Church, how are you responding to this? What's been your approach?
Well, we're building power, right? We have an organization called AIR, Advocates for Immigrant Rights and Reconciliation, that is building power with allies. We have a real significant ally with the Social Witness Action Task Force at Village Presbyterian Church. Together with them, we're building a bond fund.
This is on the Kansas City side, the church here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Johnson County.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Village Presbyterian.
Village Presbyterian,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So together with these folks on this Social Witness Action Task Force, we are building a bond fund from which we can draw to help people, because they need to be able to be out to be with their children or to be with their family so they can defend themselves and so they can live lives outside of these detention centers. So anytime someone has a bond, we're going to see if we can find a way to help them pay off that bond quickly so they can get out.
You know, are some of your members even uneasy about coming to church, Rick, for fear that they could be arrested outside and taken away?
There have been those moments, particularly when rumors begin to spread that...
There
are lots of rumors, and those happen. But what I found more than anything else is that people have a tremendous amount of courage and faith that they'll be able to come and worship God with us together. And like I said, I think that rather than focus on, I think you asked Veronica something that about should we be trying to get people to feel sorry for this situation. We don't need people to feel sorry. We need people to feel human and to act on the basis of that humanity and act for justice and peace and reconciliation and act in favor of the kingdom of God in this world.
Ramon, I'm just struck by the fact there is clearly an army of lawyers out there willing to help folks like Veronica. Describe that to me. What's going on out there on the legal front?
And so following Rick's optimism, there is a silver lining of lawyers collaborating, getting organized. And so when family detention started in 2014 in South Texas, there have been weekly
groups of volunteers going down there every single week to represent families like hers. That's how I met her, because I was living in South Texas with that project. We've seen this across the country with lawyers coming together at JFK after the travel ban, or at this moment in Sheridan, Oregon, where they're detaining some of these separated parents at federal prisons. There are teams of lawyers, us included, there to provide legal counsel to make sure that their rights are being protected. And if I may, you asked a question to her that I'd like to follow up on, mm-hmm. About what she would respond to someone that looks at her and says, you crossed illegally, if that's okay that you're detained. It isn't illegal. And I think we're fighting the same battle. If what folks are concerned about is the rule of law, then we're on the same side. Because
the law allows folks in Veronica's predicament to cross over.
Absolutely. It's the 14th article of the Declaration of Human Rights. It's the right to seek asylum. It's in the Constitution that everybody should have access to due process, the right to see a judge before the government takes your life or liberty. The Supreme Court has established that time and time again, that undocumented folks and especially asylum seekers have that same access as all of us.
President Trump is saying maybe that shouldn't be happening.
That's the concern. And that's what we should all be concerned about, I think.
Ramon, if you would, please tell Veronica we wish her the best and thank her for coming on today and sharing her story.
Entonces, Veronica, le deseamos la mejor suerte con su vida y su caso, y le agradecemos mucho el hecho de que usted vino para compartir su historia con nosotros.
Gracias a ustedes.
Thank you very much. And that's Veronica. She's joined by Ramon Valdez, who's with the Innovation Law Lab. Ramon, thank you very much. And the Reverend Rick Behrens, senior pastor at Grandview Park Presbyterian Church in KCK, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve, for having us.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about who should be giving you advice when it comes to your own health care. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yesterday on the show, we learned why reducing residential segregation could reduce racial inequality and lead to better community health and happiness. Hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the number of pregnant and new mothers dying in Missouri is going up. We learn why more women are dying here and what practitioners, patients, and lawmakers can do to increase the odds of survival. Well, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called author and scientist Paul Offit a biostitute, whatever that is. Jim Carrey called him a profiteer. Jenny McCarthy said he was bad people. And yet Paul Offit says you shouldn't listen to celebrities or politicians anyway, at least when it comes to science. These days, science continues to come under attack by people who have their own beliefs. Problem is, science doesn't cater to beliefs. Paul Offit has a new book out. It's titled Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Paul Offit is the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Paul, people are so confused out there when it comes to getting good health information. If Jenny McCarthy isn't a good source, where can people turn?
Well, I mean, in theory, the best people to provide advice would be people who have expertise and experience in the subject, whether it's a scientist or a clinician. But, you know, those groups generally aren't very media savvy. So the people that step into the fold are people that are. So activists and celebrities and politicians are often who we hear from about health, and it's not to our advantage.
It's not to our advantage because they just don't sometimes know really what they're talking about?
Yeah, pretty much all the time, I would say. Yes, they don't know what they're talking about. Although it's interesting when you led with sort of, you know, when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. or Jim Carrey Jenny McCarthy chose to vilify me. It was one of those rare moments when my children looked at me with genuine pride. They couldn't believe that these people had taken time out of their active, busy, celebrity-filled lives to vilify me. They thought that was great.
I laughed when I read it in the book, and I'm laughing here now. This is hardly a new problem. It's been going on for a while. So why did you write the book now?
Well, I think the administration, the current administration, has sort of made this more okay. It's certainly not new that people declare their own truths, like vaccines cause autism, or climate change isn't real, or creationism is just as valid of a hypothesis as evolution. But I think now when you have, for example, a secretary of Department of Education who is a creationist, or, you know, the head of the EPA who is a climate change denier, it's different. And we pay a price for this. I, you know, we are a society that's built on science and technology, where very, very little is known, I think, by most people about science and technology. And I think we've I think science is losing its platform as a source of truth.
To what extent, I'm wondering, is the media the problem here when it comes to getting good, reliable information on health? Because you have your own series of horror stories when it comes to your own interactions with the media that are sprinkled throughout this book.
Yeah, I think the media can be great or awful. The media is generally interested in being interesting, and sometimes that means being evoking controversies where there are none. You know, certainly early on, I would say, in 10 or 15 years ago, when I first started to try and weigh in on the issue of vaccine safety, I often found that I was in a situation where there would be one person on one side talking about the safety of vaccines and somebody else decrying vaccines, when really only one side was supported by the science, and that certainly isn't to the consumer's advantage. Although I suspect it's to the advertiser's advantage because it's more interesting.
You know, you point out that people tend to believe whoever is doing the talking, so that a charismatic scientist with lousy data can turn out to be more convincing than an awkward scientist with quality data. Appearances ultimately win out. Why is that the case? I mean, aren't we smarter than that?
No, we're not.
No.
Why do we listen to someone like Jim Carrey? Because we think we know him. We see him on the big screen. We see him in roles that are where he seems to be a sympathetic and occasionally smart guy. And so we think we know him because we know his roles. But, you know, he shouldn't be talking about vaccine safety, nor should Jenny McCarthy be talking about vaccine safety. They're not experts in the subject. But, you know, this is a time when I think it's very hard also for scientists to do it, because scientific training, frankly, is the opposite of media training. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're taught to be very careful, to have your discussion section of a paper loaded with caveats. And when you get on the media, often it sounds like you're waffling, and it's not terribly convincing. You're not taught how to interact with media. I mean, I was on the Colbert Report a couple times. I can tell you that standing in a windowless concrete block room at the Wistar Institute inoculating mice for 20 years was not training for that.
So what should people do then? Because it's a confusing world out there. People are dealing with so many issues when it comes to a problem with their computer or a problem with their kids. They're looking for quick, simple answers. And maybe that's sort of the issue here, right?
Yeah, I do think it is our fault to some extent, us being scientists. I do think that we need to weigh in. We need to get in the game. We need to get out of the lab and get used to the fact that being in the media is not easy or necessarily even fun. But at least you need to weigh in, because personally, I was funded for more than 25 years by the National Institutes of Health to work on what became a rotavirus vaccine that was licensed a little more than 10 years ago. I mean, who paid my salary? It was the taxpayer that paid my salary, was the voter that paid my salary, and they can just as easily stop doing it. I think people need to realize, we scientists need to realize, that science is not a right, it's a privilege, and it's a privilege that could just as easily be taken away from us. So I think we need to weigh in. But in answer to your question, I do think the internet is a source of great and awful information. Mm-hmm. So there is good information on the internet. I would say just one thing to do when you're looking on a site is don't trust the ones that are trying to sell you something, as a general rule.
What other tips would you offer?
Well, I think you should. There are, so for example, if you want to learn something about medicine, the Mayo Clinic has a very good site. Harvard has a very good site. I mean, there are medical or scientific institutions that have good websites. The CDC, I think, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a good website. So I think our hospital, the Vaccine Education Center, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I think has a good website about vaccines. And so there are people that are really trying to get information out there. But it is hard, I think, to get above the sort of massive noise level that's out there for people that are trying to get advice.
Paul Offit's new book is Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Paul was on our show last year about his book, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong. You say in here, and you just mentioned this a minute ago, that it's okay to be skeptical of scientists, but not the scientific method. What do you mean by that? And remind us what the scientific method is.
Right. So the scientific method is you formulate a hypothesis, you establish burdens of proof, you subject those burdens of proof to statistical analysis, and hopefully you will do a study that will be reproducible, that is strong, internally consistent, robust, and that is reproduced by other researchers, you know, working in different parts of this world, looking at different populations of people, and then you can say that a truth emerges. But scientists get it wrong all the time. That's okay. I mean, you know, there was in 1935, Egas Moniz won a Nobel Prize for his invention of leucotomy, which was a surgical treatment for a variety of psychiatric illnesses. When it crossed the Atlantic Ocean, it was called lobotomy, and we did 20,000 lobotomies in this country, that which only did harm. I think some people will look at that and say, see, that's why you can't trust science. But, you know, lobotomies didn't stand the test of time. Frankly, you know, the notion, as Ansel Keys did in the mid-50s, who sort of drive us to the so-called heart-healthy diet, that, you know, that butter was bad because it contained animal fat, but that margarine was good because it was partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, driving us into the waiting arms of trans fats, which caused 250,000 heart-related deaths a year. And now we know that that was wrong. And, you know, Time magazine more recently had a cover that said, eat butter, as we learned that. And again, people will say, see, you can't trust science. But science, the scientific method ultimately does produce truths. You know, gravity is a truth. Evolution is a truth. Climate change is a truth. You know, vaccine safety is a truth. Mm-hmm. It's not ultimately absolutely safe, but certainly the benefits outweigh the risks. I mean, those truths do emerge. And so I think you can trust the process.
It's interesting. One of the problems you say that scientists have in this world today is how they're portrayed, you know, in movies, on TV, as they're sort of stumble bummy, bumping around the laboratory. They're oblivious to the outside world. You suggest that isn't helping.
Right. Well, in terms of basic science, I mean, how many basic scientists are there in the United States? I mean, people who work in the lab, you know, probably about 0.3%. Most people don't know basic scientists. And so we have these sort of images on television or in the movies. I mean, you know, somebody like the Christopher Lloyd character, you know, sort of, you know, weird looking, you know, guy who kind of stumbles around. I mean, that's sort of people's image of a scientist, kind of nerdy, you know, often thick, dark glasses, you know, sort of the white
right.
coat and this sort of tousled
right.
hair. And, you know, that's the scientist. That actually isn't most people I know. But, you know, it is the image that we have. And scientists are, I think, generally, you know, shy and introverted. I mean, you don't see them, you know, doing screaming shirtless at football games or doing stand-up comedy. You know, they are a generally introverted lot. But I do think that they're the ones who need to sort of get out of the lab and start talking.
And maybe they need to talk to movie producers about portraying themselves more accurately.
That would be a good start. I mean, it's interesting. When Aaron Eckhart played a role of a geophysicist in the movie The Core, the 2003 movie, he actually spent a couple months with real geophysicists and wrote an article about it. He was so surprised that they were pretty much just like everybody else that he just felt compelled to write an article about it. But, you know, and I think Martin Luther King Jr.'s line, you know, that we have guided missiles but misguided men, that the notion that, you know, that scientists are somehow apart from us, different, other, and they're, you know, they're working, you know, arguably for us mostly, but not necessarily. And I just think we need to be more familiar so that people know us, see us.
You know, a lot of the basis for this book is the serious confusion about vaccines and people like Jenny McCarthy who are so passionately against them. Before I have you tell the story of Andrew Wakefield, who is another central figure in that ongoing debate, I want to go to a phone call here. And Anne from Overland Park. Anne, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Anne.
Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, yeah, Jenny McCarthy is a very hot topic for me. I've been working in the area of autism for 30-plus years. I have many parents who discuss feeling guilty because they vaccinated their child and they're just sure that's what caused the child to have autism. People like her have made a lot of money. She's claimed that she cured her son of autism that was given to him by a vaccination, and she has made a lot of money writing books on a study that was junk science from the jump. The problem is that science doesn't get enough press. And so now we have a population of people who are starting to not vaccinate their children, which leaves the rest of my kids at school at risk. And I think that it's a national conversation that we need to have. Because if people are not trusting what we know is the best for our kids, then we have a real problem going forward. I worry about my grandkids.
Right.
And how many people in the population are choosing not to vaccinate over something that is not true.
You know, I appreciate the phone call. And, Paul, I don't gather you would find a lot to argue about there.
No, but it raises an interesting point. I obviously completely agree with Ann. When Jenny McCarthy launched her anti-vaccine crusade, she did it on Oprah. And so there she was, her and Oprah, on the show. And she tells a very dramatic story. You know, my child was fine. The doctor gave him that shot, that autism shot, which was to her the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And then, quote, the soul left his eyes, she says, as tears are rolling down her face. Now, I was asked to be on that show. And, you know, you think on the one hand, well, you know, I probably know more about vaccines than Jenny McCarthy or Oprah Winfrey. Maybe I can calm the waters, but that's not what that show's about. A show that's watched by millions of people. Oprah is there to tell a story, and her story has three roles. There's the hero, the victim, and the villain. Jenny's the hero. Her son is the victim. This leaves only one role for you. You can't possibly win on that show. And frankly, you know, you're there to tell Jenny McCarthy that vaccines don't cause autism. She knows the cause. You don't, because the cause or causes of autism aren't clear. She has a series of treatments, as Ann alluded to, and you don't. You know, cures, claims Jenny. And, you know, also, you know, you're a guy and you know, telling two women they're wrong in front of a studio audience of 100% women. It's not exactly your home court advantage.
So you said no to it.
I said no to it. That's right. But think about it. I mean, you would like to have some way to get on that show that clearly did influence people, as Ann said. I mean, people see Jenny McCarthy, you know, fighting back tears on that show because she believes that vaccines cause autism. And even though 17 studies have now been done showing that you're at no greater risk of getting autism if you got the MMR vaccine or not, it's hard to make those stories as compelling and emotional, as passionate as Jenny McCarthy's story. And that's part of the problem.
Well, tell us the story. I mentioned Andrew Wakefield a few minutes ago, who became this big international spokesman for anti-vaccine activists. Who was Andrew Wakefield and what did he do, Paul?
Right. So he's a British gastrointestinal surgeon who in 1998 published a paper in a really well-known general medical journal called The Lancet, claiming that 12 children in his study, 8 of whom had autism, developed autism within a month of receiving the MMR vaccine. So you could argue in the best case, giving him the most benign interpretation, he had raised the hypothesis. He hadn't tested his hypothesis. I mean, it was just 8 children who got autism within a month of receiving vaccines. You could have easily published an article saying, here's 8 children who ate peanut butter sandwiches within a month of developing autism. I mean, basically, that was the level of that paper. But he raised the hypothesis, which was then clearly refuted by study after study after study in 7 different countries, on 3 different continents. Tens of millions of dollars were spent looking at this hypothesis, which never made biological sense. But it's been very hard to undo that. And he also continues at some level to be a spokesman for this. I mean, he's been marginalized. He moved to Florida, then he moved to Austin, Texas. And recently there was a movie made about him called The Pathological Optimist, which was basically ignored. So I do think he's been completely marginalized. But to a group of parents, he still is sort of a guru because he's unwilling to admit that he was ever wrong. And that, to many people, is very seductive, the notion that he's so certain it when clearly he was wrong.
There was you know, an outbreak of measles in Kansas this spring. 22 people in 3 counties wound up being infected. And, you know, Andrew Wakefield had a role there, too, didn't he?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about in Kansas. He certainly did in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, okay.
There was an outbreak among the Somali community in Minnesota.
That's
he had
right.
visited that community several years earlier. And before he visited that community, the immunization rates against measles were in the 92% range. Afterwards, it dropped to 42%, and there was an outbreak. And children suffered a pretty awful disease. I think, you know, part of the problem here also is I think we've not just only largely eliminated measles from the U.S., we've eliminated the memory of measles from the U.S. So
yeah.
People don't know just how sick that virus can make you. But yes, I think you can argue he was arguably directly responsible for that lowering of the immunization rate, which caused children to suffer needlessly. It's just unconscionable.
Huh. How frustrating is it ultimately for you, Paul, for you to see people make poor decisions based on bad evidence and really not be able to do much about it?
Very frustrating. I mean, you know, medicine has limits. There's only so much that we can do. There at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, there certainly are diseases for which we have little to offer, you know, so pancreatic cancers or you know, brainstem cancers, brain cancers. The you know, and so you know, we do the best we can. But this is something we do know. I mean, we do know that specific germs cause specific diseases. We do know that, that vaccines can prevent those diseases. And when you watch a parent make a bad decision based on bad information that caused them to come into our hospital and suffer and occasionally die, and there's not a year that goes by at our hospital where we don't see a child suffer or die from a vaccine-preventable disease because the parent made that decision because they've gotten bad advice or bad information from the groups that I just mentioned. It's incredibly frustrating. And so we just have to really get out there and try and make our case as passionately and compassionately and compellingly as the other side is doing.
Well, Paul, give us some hope here as we wind up this conversation. I mean, is the threat beginning to subside? Are people becoming a little wiser out there about where to get information about their own health? What are you seeing?
I certainly think the media has gotten dramatically better now as compared to, say, 15 years ago. They're much less likely to cover this story, say, the vaccine safety story, with two sides when only one side is supported by the science. That's definitely true. But I think at the heart of this, I think, is that at some level we've ceded our expertise. I mean, we want parents and patients to be part of the decision-making process. And when you do that, you realize that, you know, they're going to be getting information that may not be good information. And, you know, you have to at some level stand back and watch them make a decision, which is often based on poor information. I'll give you a specific example. Sometimes people will come to me and they'll say, you know, I've done my research and I've decided not to get the chickenpox vaccine. But what they mean by research really is just looking at people's opinions about the vaccine on the internet. I mean, they're not reading the roughly 700 articles that have been written about the chickenpox vaccine, which would require a certain level of expertise that most people don't have. Frankly, the most doctors don't have. So, you know, what we do is we depend on those bodies like advisory committees to the CDC or the American Academy of Pediatrics that collectively have that expertise, that have collectively read those papers and collectively have made decisions that have largely dramatically decreased the incidence of chickenpox in this country. But that is not a message that sells in the 21st century. Trust us, we're experts, is not a measure that's not a message that sells. So we're living with that.
Paul Offit's new book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Paul, thanks for joining us again. So good to have you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on the show, hear from Kansas and Missouri ACLU leadership about what's been keeping them busy. We'll discuss funding for public defenders, inmate health care, freedom of speech in schools, and a whole lot more. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can also follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. We'll be right back.